Hello from the banks of the canal outside the Guardian's offices. The sun is shining, the barges are bobbing, the water birds are babbling, and all the hubbub of King's Cross is going on in the background. And oh God, I'm going all poetic. Jonathan Raven certainly wouldn't approve of that. He's a far more sophisticated observer of landscape, as you can hear from this piece, Mississippi Water.
Flying to Minneapolis from the west, you see it as a theological problem. The great flat farms of Minnesota are laid out in a ruled grid, as empty of surprises as a sheet of graph paper. Every gravelled path, every ditch, has been projected along the latitude and longitude lines of the Township and Range Survey System. The farms are square. The fields are square. The houses are square. If you could pluck their roofs off from over people's heads, you'd see the families sitting at square tables in the dead centre of square rooms. Nature has been stripped, shaven, drilled, punished and repressed in this right-angled, right-thinking Lutheran country. It makes you ache for the sight of a rebellious curve, or the irregular, dappled colour of a field where a careless farmer has allowed his corn and soybeans to cohabit. But there are no careless farmers on this flight path. The landscape is open to your inspection as to gods, as an enormous advertisement for the awful rectitude of the people. There are no funny goings on down here, it says. We are plain, upright folk, fit candidates for heaven. Then the river enters the picture. A broad, serpentine shadow that sprawls unconformably across the checkerboard. Deviously winding, riddled with black sloughs and green cigar-shaped islands, the Mississippi looks as if it had been put there to teach the God-fearing Midwest a lesson about stubborn and unregenerate nature. Like John Calvin's infamous bad temper, it presents itself as the wild beast in the heart of the heartland.
That was Chris Moran reading from Mississippi Water by Jonathan Raben. It's part of his new collection of journalism, Driving Home, and is the perfect starting point for today's podcast, which is all about landscape literature. Sarah, to be clear, we're not simply talking about landscape in literature, are we?
No, we're not. It's much more specific than that. This is literature that interrogates the landscape and thinks about what it's for, what it can tell us, both literally and metaphorically. And landscape writers are really writing about the landscape, not just incorporating it into their fiction, as was clear in that extract from Jonathan Raben's book. He's looking at the land and analysing it, parsing it, and finding out what it means for him and for everyone who's involved in it.
You interviewed him over the phone from Seattle about his book Driving Home. We'll hear that conversation later in the podcast, but going back to the definition of landscape lit, is it actually a genre?
Well, it is in my head, certainly. It's probably easiest, though, to define it by what it's not. And in my mind, it's not fiction that's full of landscape, like Thomas Hardy and Emily Bronte and people like that. It's a different thing from travel writing, which only looks at the surface of the land that it's travelling over. And crucially also, it's not the same as a geography or geology textbook, because its literariness is just as much part of the mix as its subject matter. And you can hear, I think, from the opening of Raben's Mississippi Water, that it's gorgeously lyrically written, and that's really, I think, at the heart of this sort of literature.
Now there you could hear the tapping of somebody's heels on the wonderful stones of the dock at King's Cross. So there's a little bit of landscape in this interview. Tell us, going back to the subject in hand, where did this writing come from? Is it a modern invention?
Well, its roots are probably in the 18th century with the Romantics. Wordsworth, Coleridge and Shelley, who obviously we know their poetry, which is very closely rooted in the landscape. But then Edmund Burke, who wrote a treatise on the idea of the sublime, in which he brought aspects of nature that had heretofore not been deemed acceptable to the civilised mind, such as mountains, into our sort of culture, I suppose. He really introduced them. And then it sort of threads its way all the way through to the present day and the psychogeographical writing of people like W.G. Sebald and Ian Sinclair. It's not a modern-day invention, but it does seem to be a form that's really thriving at the moment.
OK, so I think I've got what your definition of this literature is. Now let's hear from Madeline Bunting. She's just written a book called The Plot, which is an investigation of an acre of land in Yorkshire on which her father built a chapel.
Madeline, in your opinion, what is landscape literature?
Well, this is a phrase that I've never heard before. I prefer the term a sense of place for very kind of specific reasons, which is in the research that I did for my book, thinking about landscape and land and our relationship and the way we write about land and English land in particular. I felt that landscape really puts you very specifically into a very, very important key point in the development of the English relationship with land, which is the late 18th century. It's astonishing period of industrial change, technological change, scientific breakthrough, and, you know, landscape gardening. You know, it's a particular understanding that you look at the land. And really, it represents to me a moment when actually the English were really being detached from the land so that it became something they looked at rather than experienced more viscerally. And of course, mid-18th century to the mid-19th century, and I think this is the crucial issue which underlies the word and use landscape, is the peak period of the enclosure movement. So you get millions of English people being moved off the land into the cities, losing that relationship with land. And from that point onwards, land becomes something primarily you look at in terms of the English cultural imagination. And of course, that's what tourists do. And there's the signposts telling them there's the viewpoint, take your cameras. And it seems to me that's a kind of alienation. So that's why I'm a little nervous about landscape literature and prefer sense of place literature.
Several things you mentioned there that I wanted to pick up on. First of all, you're talking very specifically about England. Is this writing something that's specific to English literature?
No, I think this is such a fundamental human thing about, you know, our sense of home, our sense of belonging, our sense of identity. All of these crucial human issues are bound up with the land. And I think the reason why I talk about England so specifically was because that's what I was looking at.
What is the difference, do you think, between the sort of writing that you're doing about a place and the sort of writing that a travel writer is doing?
Well, I thought a lot about this, and in a way it was my whole rationale for writing the book from the start. I mean, I love travel writing, and you know, I've always read lots of it, and I find it really fascinating. But it seems to me that we're a culture that is really seduced by mobility, by movement and novelty. And the thing about travel writing is, of course, it's always that. It's about novelty and usually the extraordinary, and it often privileges the sort of Western gaze. So it's the Westerner going through extraordinary, remarkable experiences and discovering extraordinary, remarkable things. And the challenge for me in the book that I was writing was actually about how do we come home and find the extraordinary at home? And how do we find the extraordinary in what is familiar? So rather than looking for novelty, deliberately look for familiarity and what do we find in that familiarity? So I think travel writing was precisely, you know, the kind of I was trying to do precisely the opposite, stay put. If you abandon movement and you confine yourself to a really small geographical area, such as an acre, you know, what can you find there? There is a really kind of implicit challenge in the book, which is to say, you know, we're just moving too fast. You know, stay put, and actually all kinds of wonders end up sort of underneath your feet and above your head in the trees, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a kind of call for some sort of attentiveness, which I think our culture finds particularly hard, a kind of patience and a kind of presence.
And this leads us, I think, to poetry quite neatly, which is the place of most attentiveness probably in literature, and perhaps the place where people tend to stand still the most. Poetry was obviously very involved in the beginnings of our interest in landscape, and we've talked a bit about Keats and his poem on Mont Blanc. It's one of the most sort of, you know, well-known probably poems on landscape. And nature poetry in the US has been huge in influencing that country's perception of itself. Obviously, there's a place for landscape in fiction, but does fiction have a place in this sort of literature that we're talking about that we haven't quite found a word for yet?
Well, perhaps we'll just have to agree to disagree about how we describe it, because I would say fiction most certainly does. And I would say drama does as well. I mean, if you look at the way in which Shakespeare uses place, the blasted heath in which King Lear goes through his astonishing sort of quest for self, I think Shakespeare uses place in a very, very interesting way. And likewise with fiction. I mean, you know, I can't imagine how a book like Waterland works without such a strong sense
of place.
Waterland's
a really good example.
Yeah. But I'm sure, you know, if we sat down and thought about it, we'd very, very quickly come up with very long lists. Mill on the Floss, you know. Mm. So, yes, I think fiction is incredibly important. But I would agree with you about poetry, that this form of writing often ends up having a kind of intensity and lyricism, which is very close to poetry. And, you know, that's part of the reason why I love it so much, and perhaps
Absolutely.
You too.
Yeah. While I'm very interested in what you said about fiction and landscape, I think that my definition of this very nebulous type of literature that we're trying to pin down here is that it probably isn't the same as the way in which landscape is used in fiction, because in fiction it seems to me it's about enhancement and about a setting for the characters, whereas in the sort of literature that you're writing and that people like Zabold are writing, Jonathan Rabin in America is writing, that's about actually turning your gaze directly onto the land itself and really interrogating the land. So for me, I think we perhaps have slightly different kind of takes on it.
I would agree with you that it is a genre. It's just that, you know, how do we label it? And it seems to me that, you know, I mean, I draw the analogy with the success of the TV series Coasting. Mm. But, you know, Coasting was done as a sort of open university sort of educational programme that was going to go out in the middle of the night or something, I understand. And it turned into this kind of blockbuster that people were absolutely gripped. And what's more, it's now running almost continuously on TV. To me, that is about people who more and more are sort of fascinated by a virtual culture. And the corollary of that actually is about a real re-engagement with the kind of immediate material environment. And I think that's had a very particular national dimension in the UK, which is Scotland has been very, very interested as to what is Scottish and what is Scotland, and similarly England and what is English. So that I think that there is a real revival of this genre, even if we can't quite decide what it is. And it's about, you know, obviously the growing environmental kind of anxiety is partly driving this, a sense that what is the ground on which we stand? You know, I think we live in a very kind of anxious, insecure age. And that means you look for sort of stability. And in the end, that means, you know, often what's under our feet.
And finally, just for people who are listening and hopefully will be interested enough to want to read more about this sort of writing now, could you recommend a couple of titles for us, the books that you really think people should be reading if they want to get started in this direction?
Well, I love the work of Kathleen Jamie. And interestingly, she's both a poet and a writer.
Yes, her book Findings is just
It's funny, Findings is very divisive. It's a real Marmite book. You know, I've met so many people that love it, but I've also met so many people that kind of scratch their heads.
Really?
In a bit puzzled, because it's so quiet.
To explain, if you haven't read it, it's about Kathleen Jamie lives in the northeast of Scotland, and she pretty much writes about the area around her house, doesn't she?
And some of the landscapes immediately around her. There's a wonderful bit about Peregrine watching from her washing machine, which she's very lucky. I can't say I see many peregrines from my
Not
washing
so many
machine.
In Hackney.
Who would you pick?
Well, Jonathan Rabin for me, and we're actually going to hear an interview from him in a moment. I think that he is probably the best writer on America around at the minute. Madeline, thank you so much for coming in to talk to us. It was really fascinating.
Thank you.
That was Madeline Bunting. The plot is published by Granta. So Sarah, Madeline said that landscape literature can be fiction. More interesting to me, though, than whether fiction can be in this genre is the sort of hybrid forms it throws up. I was really taken with Ian Sinclair's Hackney, That Rose Red Empire a couple of years ago. And I noticed that although I read it as a portrait of the place in which I live, some people actually thought of it as fiction.
OK, well, actually, I'm going to stick to my guns and say it's not fiction. It's very strongly for me, it's something else. It's about a direct engagement with the land. But mentioning Ian Sinclair, I think, is very interesting, because one of the things that we haven't talked about yet is the fact that this can be a literature that is based in cities. And obviously Ian Sinclair does that absolutely brilliantly. Will Self does it now and again. Jonathan Rabin does it about Seattle, so on and so forth. And even if you, you know, we're sitting here on the canal at King's Cross in the beautiful new Guardian offices of King's Place, which we moved into in 2008. These were built on basically derelict land, which had been industrial land. The canal is now filled with sort of pleasure barges and house barges, but used to be a sort of central artery for the city for transporting goods and services. And you can see by just that kind of brief description of where we're sitting now how richly the city kind of yields up the same sort of landscape as the countryside does, except, you know, slightly different furniture, I suppose.
Yeah, so what you're talking about is what Ian Sinclair talks about, which is a sort of passionate engagement with the landscape. Now, you talked to Jonathan Raeburn, and we're going to hear that interview in just a minute. His engagement is almost dispassionate, isn't it? I mean, he's reporting it.
Yes and no. It's a very interesting question. He absolutely has the capacity to be dispassionate about places, and one of the things that we mentioned, which we'll hear in the interview, is talking about Seattle, the city where he lives, and his slightly quizzical relationship with it. But what he is deeply passionate about is not land but water, and when you get him on water, then the passion just flows, to use a watery sort of verb. So yes, passionate and dispassionate, the best kind of writer.
Well, let's hear it from the man himself. This is Jonathan Raeburn in conversation with Sarah.
Jonathan, this book is a collection of your journalism from the last 20 years. And one of the things that made it such an absorbing read for me was that all of these strands and threads that wind through your writing sort of come up through it. And we have things like the city of Seattle, which reappears again and again, life in America generally, and most importantly of all, probably the creation and manipulation of landscape. And when you put all these pieces together in one place, did you expect to see these subjects emerging so strongly, or was it a surprise to you too?
You know, Nabokov was once asked about the origins of writing Lolita, and sphinx-like, he, as usual, he replied that it started with him reading a newspaper story about a kept ape in a Californian research institution, and the ape had been given crayons and paper by his captors. And for days and days, and maybe months and months, the ape produced nothing except meaningless squiggles, until one morning they went into his cage and picked up a piece of paper, and he'd actually done something representational that they could recognize. And what the ape had drawn were the bars of his cage. And I think that, you know, that's what, for many writers, writing is essentially about. It's about trying to draw the world that circumscribes us, the bars of our cage, which are landscape. And I was sort of conscious, I think, throughout the time I was writing these pieces, that they were held together by a sense of, you know, the Bruce Chatwin's title, What Are We Doing Here? And you might regard them as an ape, you know, the work of an ape drawing the bars of its cage, trying to figure out this strange new world in which he first found himself 20 years ago.
And you say in a piece from 2001 that landscape is land-shaped, land subordinated to a vision or a use. Do you see then writing itself as an act of landscaping?
Oh, yes, yes. I think there are all sorts of ways of making landscape, and you can make a landscape by putting up a barbed wire fence in it or planting a hedge. That's one way of making a landscape. Another way is, of course, simply to paint it or to write it, to give it a kind of order in your own head, which seems true to the actual world that you're living in. But, of course, landscape is made. You know, we shape it. We have been shaping it for as long as we've been in existence. And in turn, it shapes us. And it's that play between the force of the landscape as something much greater than oneself, and also the consciousness that we put it together. We made this thing. It's our creation. Even apparently wild landscapes, like those, for instance, of the American national parks, are the product of ideas. They are landscapes. They're not the real wilderness. The moment you take, say, a forest an old growth forest with lots of wildlife in it, like bears and mountain lions and all the rest. When you put a fence around it and equip it with rules and regulations and have armed wardens on patrol to enforce the small print of the regulations, that's not a wilderness. Mm. It's a park. It's an idea.
And you've been living in the city of Seattle since the early 90s. And it's interesting to hear you saying that you like cities. And obviously, your first book was about the city of London. But the picture of Seattle that emerges from this collection is an interesting one, because it seemed to me that you're respectful of it and you are interested in it as a place, but you never seem to be totally affectionate towards it. And you say things such as that living there can resemble perpetual breakfast time at some airport Sheraton, that its domestic architecture pines for a world elsewhere. And you end this 2007 piece on the city by saying, it seems to me that I might be anywhere. What's your feeling towards it as a place to live? You've been there for quite a while now, haven't you?
Well, as Philip Larkin said, we all hate home and having to be there. And I, you know, people sometimes say, well, do you still love Seattle? No, any more than I loved London when I lived in London. It's a real and complicated place. You know, I don't have either unstinted love for it, nor do I hate it. I mean, it's my cage.
Yes, I suppose.
And I'm drawing it.
That's the interesting thing about it, I suppose, is this idea of this being the locus from which you're seeing the rest of the world, you know, accidentally or on purpose. It's where you're viewing the world from, and that presumably has an impact on the way in which you view the rest of the world.
Oh, yes, I think so. And Seattle is an interesting place because it's not Washington, D.C. It's not New York. It's a perch on the top left-hand corner of the United States from which one is looking across the whole landscape of the U.S., all, you know, 3,000 miles of it. And inevitably, one's version of, for instance, American politics becomes distorted by that distance. It also happens to be the city which is closest by sea to any port you can name in Asia. And the Asian connection is intensely strong. I mean, I think that there is this sort of theory of the two coasts, the Pacific coast being inclined towards Asia, and then the Europhile East Coast tipping towards Europe. And I'm very conscious, I mean, as somebody who comes from Europe, of being at, as it were, the end of the U.S., the Pacific end, and the Asian influences on, you know, where I live, as a very, very different city from, you know, the obvious East Coast cities, to which most Europeans tend to gravitate, or they gravitate to L.A., of course, on the West Coast. Mm. But Seattle is interesting, peculiar. It has its own economy. It has its own architecture and life. And it does afford a very, very, I think, interesting perch from which to look, as it were, eastwards, both towards D.C. and New York, and further than that to London, Paris, wherever.
And we've talked throughout this conversation about landscape and land, the reading of land and the writing about land. But obviously, anyone who reads your work will know, it's often water, not land, that you're actually talking about. And one of my favourite pieces from this collection was the 1993 piece from, I think it ran originally in Granta magazine, about the great flood of the American Midwest, and the whole piece is absolutely wringing wet. What does water in a landscape mean to you? Why do you keep returning to it?
I don't know, just sort of ancient infantile obsession, I think. I mean, I remember, some of my earliest memories as a child growing up in Norfolk was of the River Wensum, which ran just down the street from where we live. And as soon as I was old enough to do so, maybe 4 and a half, I would take myself down to that river and be transfixed by the sort of subaqueous life of the river itself, you know, clear pools with roach swimming in them, that kind of thing. I've always loved water, and I've never tried to explain to myself exactly why I love water. I just do.
So, having now collected all of this journalism together, are you writing another book?
I am, yes.
Would you like to tell us about it?
I daren't. Bad karma to talk about what you're going to put the phone down and go on and try and write afterwards.
It's been a real pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for talking.
That was Jonathan Raeburn. Driving Home is published by Cape. Now, next week, we're launching a new series in which we meet some of our favourite writers and ask them about the six books which have changed their lives. To kick us off, we ask some of the top Guardian writers which single book has been most important to them. Sarah, since I've got you here, let's have yours to begin with.
OK. Well, actually, the book that I'm going to choose, it might be different on any given day, but today, since we're talking about landscape, despite the fact that I would contend that fiction has no place in landscape literature, I read when I was 17, I think, Bruce Chatwin's novel. And he's actually a landscape writer in another guise, but he wrote a novel called On the Black Hill. I think it made me want to read, and to read beyond the books that you get given through school, the books that your parents recommend you, but to read the books that you find yourselves that are completely different from anything else that you've read. I can remember so vividly, I read the final page in my living room at my mum's house, and I had to go back and reread it because I couldn't believe that a book could do that, and it definitely sort of turned me towards literature, I think.
So now let's hear from some of our other writers.
I'm Jonathan Friedland. I write a column for The Guardian. And if I had to identify one book that really made me, and maybe many journalists would name this book, it would have to be 1984 by George Orwell.
Hello, I'm Alan Rusbridger, and I'm the editor of The Guardian. The book that changed my life was the collected letters, essays, and journalism of George Orwell.
I read it for the first time when I was about 14. It was 1983. It was 1 year away from 1984, and it was a revelation to me.
My name's Gary Young, and if I had to choose one book that really had a major impact on me, it would be The Black Jacobins by C.L.R. James. It's an account of the Haitian Revolution that was led by slaves. In its analysis, it's brilliant, and in its writing, it's incredibly lyrical, and in the scope of C.L.R. James's understanding of race and class and politics and colonialism, it is an incredibly rich study and a brilliant read.
Partly because it was just exciting and thrilling, but also I was already very interested in politics, but equally loved fiction and novels and literature, and I always thought these things were separate, that it would be impossible to have an interest in both. And then I read, or somehow to realise both, and then I read 1984, and it was as if the scales were falling from my eyes. It was possible to tell a really intensely political story that was still a story. You didn't have to give up the politics or the literature. You could do both in a single volume and make it a thrilling read at the same time.
It was a complete life-changing experience for me because it was an introduction to a form of journalism. And I'd never thought about journalism terribly deeply at the time. But here was a wonderful form of journalism, a wonderful ability to write an essay on anything, from boys' weeklies to murder to shooting an elephant to a hanging.
I've read it so many times now, I can't remember the first time I read it. But I do remember that once I'd read it, it had turned my understanding of the world in a definite direction, and it had turned my understanding of how I might do my work as a journalist in a very definite direction.
And I probably, although I've never thought about it till now, it was the thing that ended up with me being a journalist. It changed my life.
We launched this series, which we've called The Books That Made Me, with the brilliant fantasy writer China Mieville, whose choices range from The Tales of Jeremy Fisher to a 1920s Russian law book. And that's it for this week. Thanks to Jonathan Raeburn, Madeline Bunting, and our brilliant reader, Chris Moran. Please do join in the discussion about whether landscape literature really is a genre of its own, or whether it's actually just a figment of Sarah's imagination, on guardian.co.uk/books. Join me next week as I take a journey into the fabulous reading world of China Mieville. I'm Claire Armistead and the producer is Lucy Greenwell.